Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Laura Fraser, author of An Italian Affair and All Over the Map, a member of the San Francisco Writers Grotto, and your moderator for tonight's program. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, Susan Pullman, author of Halfway to Each Other, How a Year in Italy Brought Our Family Home. When Susan Pullman's marriage was in trouble, she and her husband did what their marital therapist and everyone else thought was crazy. They picked up their two children and moved them to Italy for a year. In Halfway to Each Other, Susan writes about this leap of faith and the moments of difficulty and grace they found in a small town in Liguria. Prior to moving to Italy, Susan had worked as a teacher and school administrator, and also as a freelance writer. Her essays have been published in the Washington Times, Family Digest, Raising Arizona Kids, Guideposts Magazine, Home Life Magazine, Arizona Parenting, Good Housekeeping, and ItalianNotebook.com. She's also written four award-winning short films. Halfway to Each Other is her first book and winner of the relationships category and runner-up in the memoir category in the 2010 Next Generation Indie Book Awards. It was shortlisted for the 2010 InSpy Awards. So, buonasera, auguri, benvenuto, please welcome Susan Pullman.
Thank you, Laura, for that nice introduction. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here tonight. I see some friendly faces in the audience, and I want to let you all know also my daughter is here. So if you have read the book, you get to meet two characters in the book tonight. And also thank you to the Commonwealth Club for continuing to offer space for authors and other people to come and share their stories, because I think in sharing our stories, our deep personal stories, we really push each other, and we open opportunities for thought, for, you know, opportunities for thinking, maybe I could do something like that, or maybe I can take a chance or risk in my life. So my hope for you tonight after listening to our crazy story is to leave with a seed of opportunity that, you know, perhaps you have an adventure in your future, and not to be afraid of it. That risk is okay. And sometimes it turns out to be the best thing that you've ever done. So I thought I would just start with a little background to give you a setting of where what was happening at the beginning of the story. And then I'll do a couple of readings from the book and talk a little bit about what life was like over in Italy with two shocked children for a year, and how that helped to heal our marriage and give our family new life. And after that, if I haven't covered anything that you're interested in, I'm happy to answer questions. So we should be able to do all of that tonight. So it was back in 2003. My husband and I were college sweethearts. We'd been married 18 years, had known each other 5 years prior to that. So basically, we knew each other inside and out. And we had gotten to this point in our lives and in our marriage where we really thought that our relationship had run its course. We had two children, 11 and 15, and we were living in Los Angeles. My husband had a very stressful job running six radio stations. I had chosen at that point to stay home, very traditional household. I was lucky enough to stay home with my kids and not have to work full-time outside of the home. And we had a very typical American, overscheduled life, kids in two different schools, a nice home, a lot of just a lot going on, okay? So this is what American life looks like for young families. And had reached a point where we just went like this in our marriage. You're in the same house, but you really are not sharing the sort of intimacy that you long for. I mean, what is life really but a search for intimacy? And when you are leading that kind of crazy lifestyle, you start to lose that, and you start to lose each other, and then all hell breaks loose, and it's not pretty. So I had gotten to the point of deciding to end the marriage. Very painful, especially in that my chosen profession is an educator. And what do you do for a living? You support families, you know, and you do the best you can to make children and their parents happy and cohesive and educated. So it was very ironic that I found my own family falling apart. It was a very painful time. And so I went off one day and went to a lawyer, and so here we are at this critical juncture, very sad family. So my husband comes to me one day, and he says, Susan, would you like to go on this client trip with me? And in the radio business, back when they made money, Dave is also in radio, so that's why his laughter is so loud. And they used to do things called client trips. And so basically what we would do is, as the people who run the station, we would put together a trip, and we would say to, let's say, the car dealers in town, if you will spend X amount in first quarter, we'll take you on this fabulous trip. And we had done a number of these. So we said, we have a trip coming up to Italy. Would you like to go? And my first thought was, no. And I thought, it's not really a good idea because we're not getting along well. And the objective is to attract clients and not repel them with the aura of anger around our heads right now. So he kept after me. And I'm like, finally, I'm like, all right, fine. I'm a giver. I will suffer through Italy one last trip. And then in my heart, though, I knew this would be it, you know. And so off we go. And I didn't even look up Italy on the, you know, the map. I didn't do any preparation. I'd never been there, never really wanted to go there. I didn't know anything about Italy. So we land in Florence. We were there 6 days, okay. So we land in Florence. And Florence sent me sideways. It hit me so hard, the beauty of Florence. And there is a palpable spirituality to Italy. I wouldn't believe it if I hadn't been there, but it rises up from the cobblestones, okay? So here we're in this amazing city, this ancient city, very spiritual feeling going on inside of me. I'm awed by the artwork. And I found myself during the day just like kind of weeping, just losing my composure, which is not really like me. And I can remember going to the bathroom and, like, pull yourself together. Like, what is your problem? We have all these clients that we're trying to entertain. So we're there 4 days. Unbeknownst to me, Tim is having the same sort of core shift. Neither one of us can put words to it. And we then end up in Santa Margherita Ligure, which is this gorgeous town in Liguria. And if you've never been to Italy, like if this is Italy, Liguria is right here. Okay, it's anchored by Genoa. It's right on the water. The beautiful villages of all the different colors. You know, if you think of Portofino, that's the flavor of the area. I didn't even know it existed. Again, we're both like, whoa, this is amazing. So here we are, again, day number 4 of a 6-day trip, walking down the street. We had 1 day without clients. And as we walked along the water, my husband turns to me and he says, I could live here. And I'm, you know, seeing the beautiful sun on the water and the cascading flowers and the language of the Italians. And I'm like, well, I could live here, not with you. In my mind, I'm screaming, no. But every trip we'd ever been on, we always said I could live here. That was nothing new. But then there was this change of inflection. And when you're married to someone that long and you know what they're really saying, and he turned to me and he said, no, I could really live here. Why don't we live here? And I was completely overcome with this fear because I'm thinking, this is very strange, very unlike him. But for some reason, I listened. Okay. But I didn't admit it, of course. So I'm like, no, we're not living here. That's stupid. So we walk along and go back to the hotel, and we sit outside by the pool for a while. So I'm going to read a little bit here. All right. And this is where I felt that I started to become overwhelmed with a sense of grace. And there are times in your life when your perception of the world starts to align itself with whatever the divine perception is. And there are little glimpses of truth. And this is where it began for me, where I began to really see what was true and what we needed to do, as scary as it was. Okay, so picture we're sitting on two striped lounge chairs overlooking the sea. I could quit my job. We could live off the profit from the sale of our house, said Tim. Are you crazy? I don't know. These past few days, I'm just miserable at my job. It hit me like a ton of bricks yesterday while we were crossing the Ponte Vecchio. I have not been happy there for a long time. It's like someone slapped me across the face and told me to wake up. Tim, I've been doing that for years, I said. I'm trying to be serious. Other people do crazy things. Why can't we? Well, because we don't know how to work as a team. We're terrible at compromise. Our communication skills are prehistoric. And we don't even like each other that much anymore, remember? Just think about it. That's all I'm asking. I sat back and closed my eyes and felt the hot sun wash over me. A heartbeat later, an internal voice boomed, "Do this." It was so unexpected that I sat up, opened my eyes, and peered around. Tim's eyes were still closed. The pool guy was still cute. I lay back down and told my conscience, or whatever it was, to shut up. But it didn't shut up. This commanding voice inside my head started to badger me incessantly with one simple question. Why do you want to stay anchored to a lovely lifestyle in Los Angeles that's brought you nothing but distance from the man you used to love and is teaching your children a world of skewed values? Tim, I whispered, did you ever think that maybe the life we built together, this American dream, so to speak, is the reason why we're so miserable? Tim propped himself up on his elbow to listen, his steel blue eyes intent. You just kind of get lost in the repetition of it all. But you don't really know you're lost until you're so lonely that you can't take it anymore. And the layers of your life slowly suffocate you, and then it falls apart. The marriage, the family, the house. Silence, and then Tim's eyes started to tear, which of course made mine water up as well. I think it's safe to say that we're in the lost part, really, really close to the falling apart part, he said. I nodded and tried to blink back my tears. So let's try something different, he said. So at this moment, I started to realize that the very life we had tried so hard to build, this beautiful life, was the problem. You know, there's a point where abundance, the beautiful abundance of America, it starts to work against you. And it's so lovely looking. Your life is so lovely. And everyone else's life looks so lovely that you don't realize that our own culture works opposite of what it takes to really have peace and happiness in your life. So I told him, I'll give you a day. Let's just explore this. Well, we only had a day left anyway. So we're like, all right. So we go off. We get on the train. We had no idea where we were going. None. We spoke two words of Italian, ciao and arrivederci. Zoomed off into Genoa and looked for an American school. Because I said, if there's an American school, I'll consider it. And lo and behold, we find one. And just happened to have spaces only in the grades that we needed. Okay. Take home the paperwork, go out and entertain clients. The next day we get up and I, of course, have a freak out and say, no, this is stupid. We're not doing this. And he makes me promise one more day. We're going to just check it out. I'm like, all right, fine. So off we go. We find a realtor. They didn't speak one word of English, all sign language, what we needed. We would need a furnished apartment for 1 year near the school. They said, we have one place, but we can't show you till 5 o'clock tonight. I'm like, 5 o'clock tonight? We're leaving. We have a huge dinner. We're leaving at 4 in the morning. You promised. I'm like, okay. So all day we're walking through the town trying to picture ourselves living there. And this is like a little village on the sea. This is, you know, very different from our Los Angeles lifestyle. So finally 5 o'clock comes, and then I'll just read this short little passage to you as well. And my moment of reckoning, you know, you always think you're going to get this big moment, like when you go and climb the Himalayas or someplace or Machu Picchu or something. But my moment of meeting God was in a tiny cramped elevator in an old apartment building. So 5:45, we went back to Studio Massa. That's the realtor. Jumped into Umberto's tiny silver car. He drove up winding roads up a hillside, and we parked next to a 7-story building on Via Fratelli Coda. It had a 1970s kind of feel to it, a mixture of slate, stone, and brick with gray steel balconies flat across the front. I took a breath, wiped my sweaty palms on my jeans, tapped Tim on the shoulder, said, if this place is a dump, then it wasn't meant to be. We leave tomorrow, and we drop the idea permanently, okay? Fine. And if it isn't a dump, then that's a sign we should do it. Deal. I was very confident it would be a dump. Three of us walked into the lobby, past a mirrored wall, stood before a narrow elevator door, smiling nervously at each other. The doors opened, and we squeezed inside. It felt claustrophobic, like a coffin for four, a phone booth that traveled between floors. Umberto pushed the button. And as the elevator climbed unsteadily toward the 7th floor, I was reminded of the story of the hanging elevator. It is a common metaphor used in movie writing, where you have all the unsuspecting people riding in the elevator, happy and isolated in their own lives, sure that they are in complete control of their destiny. But the viewer sees that the elevator cable is starting to unthread, and soon the elevator will plunge to its demise. The people inside begin to argue over something petty, and the audience sits on the edge of their seats aghast. The passengers are wasting the last moments of their lives on something useless and without virtue. I knew in that instant that Tim and I were those people missing the point of life entirely, and it became undeniably clear that I was not in complete control of this decision. There was a greater force at work, and all of a sudden, everything that was wrong between us seemed trivial, in contrast to the importance of preserving the sanctity of our family. And then it was me and God face to face in the elevator, and I knew that this would be my defining fork in the road. After 44 years of Christian living, how much did I really believe in love? How much faith did I really have? And did I have the courage to surrender and put my life in God's hands? The longest elevator ride of my life halted. The doors opened to an open-air staircase. We ascended 3 steps to the front door and took one last breath together. The realtor jiggled the key left and right. The door opened to an expansive view of sea and sky and sun-washed coastline, visible through floor-to-ceiling glass doors that ran the length of the entire apartment. Tim and I gasped in awe and looked at each other petrified. Oh, no, I said. Now I have to do this. So we did it. We just took that piece of paper, was written completely in Italian. We just signed it. I had no idea what I signed. It's ridiculous. So we came home. Tim quit his job the next day. We sold our house. And I just want to make it clear, we were not like the Rockefellers that like went off for a year on vacation. We had to sell everything to afford this. So this was a great risk, especially when I was not sure I even liked my husband anymore. But I was in such anguish over the thought of breaking up our family. I'm like, you know, we will risk everything for a job, for a house that we love. We'll risk everything for everything but our families, you know? And I'm like, am I going to be the kind of person who never takes a risk, who never takes a chance on the most important thing in my life? So if I really value my family, do I have the courage to value it? So I just said, this is it. I'm doing it. I don't care. You know, if it's a disaster, I'll come home. I'll take my children and we'll live at my parents' house in retirement, Sun City. you know. Is it so bad, you know? And so I just thought, let's just go for it. And off we went. So we sold everything. 8 weeks later, we were living in that apartment. We were all shell-shocked. And it started the most transformational, amazing, spiritual, eye-opening, broadening year of our lives. And it saved our marriage. It saved our family. And it really gave us an identity as a family. You know, for once, all four of us were going in the same direction, creating memories that we were all together doing, taking risks together, learning a language. It was magnificent. Not to say that it was easy, you know, because it wasn't. But it was worth every sacrifice. And, you know, our issues, of course, don't just fly away just because you're living on a beautiful Italian coastline. But what happens is that you find yourselves back on the same side of the fence. You have to problem solve. You know, we were there. We didn't know the language. We had two children looking at each other like, what just happened here? We had to build a life for all of us. So you don't have the luxury of being petty. You know, you just get right down to business. What's important? You know, food, shelter, belonging to each other, and you just make it happen. And so as the year began to unfold, we all started to grow in miraculous ways. The kids blossomed into a young man and woman that I didn't even know, you know, the opportunity to live in another culture and to see values that were different from our American values, just different and broadening. So, and then we ended up coming home in a year, and mostly because we ran out of money. I'll just put it out there. It was, for some reason, you think it's going to be cheaper, and it's just like, that was crazy. But, you know, you get over there, and we ended up just deciding for a number of reasons to come back home. But and starting over was difficult, and we're still kind of rebuilding because we spent our savings to do this. But honestly, I would do it again in a heartbeat because I remember when we came back home, I just said to a girlfriend, you know, if I die tomorrow, I will feel like I have lived because we just let it rip, you know, and had just an amazing, amazing time. So it was miraculous. So I'm going to stop there because there's so many directions I could go, and I know we have a limited amount of time, so I want to give you an opportunity to ask the questions that mean the most to you.
So our thanks to Susan Pullman, author of Halfway to Each Other. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest today is Susan Pullman, author of Halfway to Each Other, How a Year in Italy Brought Our Family Home. And it's time now for our audience question period. And so let's go ahead and get started. Somebody wanted to know whether Tim, your husband, did anything that really embarrassed you while you were in Italy.
This is someone I know that asked me this question. My husband is 6'8" tall, okay? He is this enormous, Mr. Clean-looking man who stands out in every single place that we go. He's a big personality. I can't say that he embarrassed us, you know, but he's very gregarious, and we have a lot of fun stories that shall not be told. But I don't think he embarrassed us.
But there were probably a lot of times when you felt, I know there were a lot of times in the book when you felt really out of place as Americans, and you felt like you had sort of done something wrong according to Italian custom. I'm wondering if you can tell us about a few of those moments of awkwardness.
Oh, gosh, where do I begin? You know, we get there. First of all, we had to order like cable and TV and a telephone. All that stuff is hard enough in English, but you try to do it in Italian, it is almost impossible. And, you know, so we would go off to the four of us, like we were joined at the hip, you know, and we'd go off and find how to do this. And I mean, literally, we like this, the phone guy became like our best friend. He's on our Christmas card list now because we had to go back so many times. But you know, all I can say is that every day we did something wrong every day because we didn't understand the culture. You know, you get on the bus. I didn't know you had to have a ticket. I thought you bought a ticket. I mean, in America, you get on, you pay the driver. Well, you get on, the driver was like, we kept trying to give him money, and he was like, what is wrong with you, you know? And we'd like, oh, this is free, you know? The bus system is free here. This is the greatest country ever. Not knowing you had to have a ticket, then go in and, like, punch it, you know, because there's invariably some huge, enormous person in front of the thing. You have to, like, stick the little machine. There's always something, you know. We were constantly getting yelled at, or, like, in the grocery store, you have to put little plastic gloves on your hands to touch the fruit. Would you know that? No. So I'm in there squeezing my tomatoes, and then there's angry Italian women around me, and I'm like, why is everyone so angry at me? You know, it's a store. You're supposed to buy things. And, you know, and then they'd have to show me that I have to put gloves on. Little things like that, just little cultural differences. And it was funny, you know.
I hope you never wore purple to a wedding.
We weren't invited to any weddings.
That's a really bad thing to do.
We did put a wreath on our door.
A bottle of wine backwards is very insulting.
We put a wreath on our door. And over there, a wreath means death. We had no idea. And the neighbor's like, you only put wreaths in the graveyard. Like, why is there one on your door? I thought this looked kind of cute, you know? So things like that. You don't understand the deeper meanings of things.
Someone asked what, I know that someone asked what were some of the things that you missed about the United States. And I know you had a hard time finding Cheetos and...
Well, junk food is completely different. You know, we went to the grocery store with this long list of must-haves, and nothing was there, you know. Everything, we were shocked because it was all ingredients in the store. There weren't, like, we're like, we have to actually make things. Like, this isn't, you know, pre-made for us. So we had to get used to new, healthy lifestyle, which I think our systems were in shock for a while. But then, you know, it's very healthy eating, and... You get used to that right away.
Did you learn to cook?
I can't say that I'm a great cook, you know. But we did learn to order great things off the menu while the kids were at school. But we tried to keep our lives very, very normal for the kids. And so we cooked regular things for dinner, you know, chicken and stuff that they liked. I mean, it was fresher and we had different ingredients and it was better. I learned to cook a little bit.
Is there anything you crave from the Gurion cuisine?
They have this great calamari that is just magnificent. All of their seafood is fresh and I miss that desperately. So, yes. Mm-hmm. Mussels.
We shouldn't be talking like this right around dinner time.
I know. Sorry.
So someone wants to know how old were your kids? I think you said 11 and 15.
They were 11 and 15.
And what was their initial reaction to moving to Italy for a year?
Well, we decided to let them both know separately so they could have their own little freak-out session without the other person watching. So first we told Katie, and she became very quiet and pale.
She's the elder of
the two. She was the elder of the two, and she was good. You know, she thought it through and kind of went for a long walk. I'm sure she cried her eyes out. But after a day, she understood that things were not good between her parents, and she embraced it. So I was like, you know what? You are awesome. So, you know, she was good. Now, Matthew was 11, and so we told him, and he just got this scary look in his face, and he said, what's Italy? He was so stunned, he could not even process the information. But because Katie was able to embrace it, it gave him permission to get excited, and probably within 3 or 4 days, we were a team. We're like, we're doing this. We're not looking sideways or back. Let's just get our checklist, figure out what we need to do, and make it happen. So they were great.
And I'm wondering how it changed them. I know my parents moved my family to Mexico when I was 10 years old for a summer, and I, from that experience, learned to love languages, and I learned to love travel. And so I'm wondering if it's changed your kids forever.
Absolutely. Couple things, you know, besides that, they both love culture now, and the differences in culture and the traveling was really fun as a family. But what I noticed as a mother was that my children became interdependent, whereas living in Los Angeles, they didn't need to depend on each other at a deep level. You have these lives that are, you know, you take care of your kids' every need, you know, and you drive them here, you drive them there, and they sort of, they're 4 years apart, so they had separate lifestyles, really, a boy and a girl. You have your own things, and they didn't rely on each other emotionally, really. So in Italy now, here they have been sentenced to this event together, and they turned toward each other and really became friends. So that was the most profound part for me as a mom, watching them grow in that direction.
And that's kind of what happened with you and your husband.
Exactly. Yeah, you turned toward each other rather than away from each other. It was remarkable. So then they enjoy a deeper relationship now because of that.
And did the spell wear off? I mean, I know when I'm in Italy, I just feel like everything is right with the world, and I feel happy. And it's just, as you say, it just comes up from the cobblestones. And then I come back home, and it's sort of, I'm not in Italy anymore. How did you feel when you came home? Did you still have that sense of grace, that sense of lightness of being, that sense of slowness in your day?
That's a great question, because, you know, you do have to live in the culture you're in. However, it has changed in the fact that we've been able to question our culture. I never thought to question it before. You know, as a young mom, so busy, just like a rat race, but everyone's life looked that way. So you just figure, well, that's just the way it is, you know. But when we came back, we had to work really hard at keeping things simple. We did not rebuild. We did not put all those things back into our lives. Even like our social lives now are very quiet. We used to be like, there's a party, the Pullmans are there. You know, we just enjoyed our fun. And we still enjoy our fun. But, you know, too much is too much. Even too much of a good thing is too much, because you go off and you're still not talking to each other. So we recognize that we needed to simplify every single area of our life, and that's what works for us, and it matters, you know. So, you know, is it magic every night? No, you know, you still have tough days, but having had that experience, you treasure each other more, I think.
What was it about Italy that led you to that greater sense of intimacy? I mean, aside from what you said about you're in a foreign country, you're both on the same side of the fence, how do you think it would have been different if you'd gone to Russia or Cuba or, you know?
You know, the Italian culture is magnificent. It just is. It's very sensual. It's slower. I love that they take 3 hours off in the middle of the day to be with their family, to go home and eat, take a nap. You know, we literally were in stores waiting to pay, and people were angry at us for being there at noon. You know, leave my store, I need to go home. They would rather than make the sale. So that makes a difference. You know, their manner is emotional and beautiful. That language is gorgeous. I don't know. You know. I mean, there's something about the Italian culture that fills you. It fills your soul. It feeds your soul.
One of the things I love.
The fresh foods and the.
One of the things I loved about your book was I felt like you articulated a lot of the reasons that I love Italy. You know, you talk about how you go out at night and people are having a passeggiata. They're just walking around, and that's what they're doing for fun. They're walking arm in arm and just being with each other outside in the town. Everyone's dressed up. You can sort of see what everyone else is wearing, and that's, you know, that's their entertainment. And, you know, you talked about going to the beach. I loved this because you said, you know, in LA or wherever in the United States, we're also like, oh, how's my bod? Do I have the bikini bod? And whereas you go to Italy and they don't care. They're just all out there. It's their bodies. They're on the beach. They're, you know, wearing whatever. And I love the way you describe shopping in all the little shops, you know, instead of going to a big grocery store. So I loved the way you brought out all of those lovely things about Italy.
Yeah, it's just a simpler way of life, you know. And when you're there, you can feel that the younger generation is trying to change some of that, you know, with the globalization. And that is, I ached for them, for the country, because we actually walked through a couple of demonstrations. We wrote about one in the book, you know, pro and con for the globalization is a very emotional issue because the small restaurants are all owned by families. And but it's charming, and it keeps people anchored to their home, and it's a very beautiful way of life.
A couple more questions here. How did the locals treat you when you were first there? You're tall, you're blonde, you don't speak any Italian. What did they make of you?
Okay, this is a good question, because we arrived there. Yes, we're all inordinarily tall, okay? And we look German, really, the four of us. And at first, we stuck out like a sore thumb, and people kind of stared, didn't really know what to make of us. And we had a wonderful big family that lived below us. Annalisa is the mom's name, and she was very vibrant and huggy, and four children, and a very quiet dad. But what we kind of, you know, they befriended us, okay, and showed us the ropes. They were wonderful. And as we got to know them, they would say, "So what are you doing here?" And we're like, "Well, we're here. We're just taking a year off." And they're like, "Huh, what are you really doing here? You know, what are you really doing here?" And so then a month would go by, and she'd ask us again, and she'd ask us again. So everyone was talking about us. We didn't realize that, but, you know, what's this family doing here is very odd, because you don't have that happening in the Italian culture. So in their minds, that we were on the witness protection program. No joke. That's not even a joke. So to the extent that when we came back to the States, the daughter, who Elisabetta, who lived below us, came to visit, and she's a 17-year-old girl. And Annalisa said to her, "When they're not home, I want you to go peek through Tim's files and see if you see anything suspicious." And so then she asked a friend of hers who was working at Quantico from Italy, went to Quantico for a little, you know, course or something, to run a search on our name, just to make sure. Like, she couldn't let it go. She just couldn't believe that we would be a normal family that would come over and just live there and not be criminals of some sort or on the run, you know. So, but other than that, we were treated beautifully.
Now, speaking of criminals and suspicions, you have a scene where you're walking through the town and you see these old men just sitting around drinking espresso, and you immediately think mafia. Never mind you're in northern Italy and not southern Italy, but you think mafia. And I'm wondering what sorts of stereotypes you took with you to Italy and how your ideas about Italy changed being there.
Well, that was really the only one, to be honest with you. I mean, there are certain men, and you see them every day on the same bench, every day. You know, and it's not just like, oh, you know, once in a while you see the same person. It's like, what is the deal that these four men are sitting here every single day, you know? And so what else could be the reason, you know? I mean, the real reason is that they're hanging out together, having coffee, and they were just friends, and they were retired, and that's what they do. But as an American, you think, huh, just like they're thinking that we're on the lam, I'm thinking that they're, you know, the stereotype takes over. But other than that, I don't think we really had any stereotypes, because the things that I thought about Italians were true. Great passion, great food, beautiful language. You know, I didn't really have a lot of negative stereotyping
and
in
then
my mind.
Talking about language, how's your Italian after your?
It is terrible, honestly. Here, I'm an English teacher. So I thought I would go over there and, like, pick it up. Like, I would be great at it. And I was the worst of all, the entire family, at trying to learn Italian. It is a difficult language. And I
17 verb tenses.
Yeah, there's so many endings that you're just like, whatever happened to ED and ING, you know? But I had a hard time with the language. And it took me a while to even hear the breaks between words. And then once I was able to do that, and then I was became friendly with some people who you're around them a lot, and with the help of sign language, you start to pick it up. You start to learn it. And by the end, I could understand a lot, but I really couldn't speak. You know, my daughter, Katie, was very good at it. She ended up minoring in Italian. She took to the language. Matthew was great. My husband just like was like a bull in a china shop. He just he would go in and just say whatever words and be really proud of it. And because he was so charismatic, everyone just, you know, made him feel like he was fluent. And so it just, it was fun, you know. But I was scared and timid and, you know, it was hard for me. But I can order off a menu just fine. It was
Italians are so forgiving, unlike mm-hmm. the French. I remember when I was in Italy the first time I went into a produce store, I was too scared to try to order anything else. I just pointed at the produce, and the guy, you know, sort of grumpily put them in my bag. So I thought, okay, I'm going to learn how to order, you know, produce. So I went in the next morning. I said, buongiorno, mezzo chilo di pera, mezzo chilo di mele or whatever, and he looks up like he's looking at heaven and saying, in one day she can speak Italian, you know. And then that was it for me. I was like, I'm learning Italian. Italians are so
the butcher shop is
that.
The scariest store, just yeah. to let you know, because yeah. there are heads on things, and you know, it's just meat is presented in huge enormous slabs, and what do you do with that, you know? So that was the scariest part for me.
Someone wanted to know, at what point during the year did you realize that your marriage would survive, and did you have any moments when you thought about splitting up even after you committed for the year? And then what would you do? You know, move to Florence while he stays there? I mean,
yeah, you know, it was gradual. It was a gradual process. And what we did find, luckily, is when we arrived there, we share the same sense of humor. And there was so much humor that it was healing right off the bat. We laughed all the time. So when you weren't laughing, you were crying because you were shell-shocked. But we laughed a lot, and that helped. And then as time went on and you start to relax and become rested, I don't think we realize as a culture how exhausted we are. We were different people after about 6 to 8 weeks. When you are rested, it's like we were who we used to be. And so you remember what attracted you to each other in the first place, and you have this, like, wow, I still like you. Like, we're still having fun. And even though you have baggage with you at this point, you begin to make new, very profound memories that they just lay on top of the old ones and kind of bury them in a good way, you know. So probably about 6 months into the year, I just relaxed and I said, this is good, you know. We're climbing out of our deep hole and we're having fun, and I'm just going to let that go and move forward, because, you know, the past is the past. So what do you want your future to look like? And make it happen, you know. And we still loved each other through whatever issues we had, and so then we just moved on. Just
tell us about some of the other travels that you had in Europe. There were some very funny scenes in your book about some of those places you visited, the naked swimming pool in Switzerland.
We traveled. Our first trip was to Lucerne. We went up, and we'd all never been on a train. You know, traveling by train is magic, you know, with kids especially. You'd watch all the different countries. You go from country to country, and you can actually see the signage, the wording, and then you see the architecture change. You know immediately when you're in a new country. And we traveled extensively through. We went to Germany and Switzerland and Spain. We went all over Italy, like everywhere. So almost anything you could do by train, we did in a year. And it was magnificent, too. And the interesting thing, the magical part of it, is that we would pick a destination and we wouldn't plan it. We would arrive. Sometimes we had a hotel, and sometimes we didn't. We would get off the train. Everyone got to bring one backpack. And then at one point, we bought a dog, which, you know, was ridiculous. But now, so it was the four of us and a dog. And we would just walk and find a hotel, check in, and then have our little adventure. And what we learned was to trust life as it's presented to you. And you're never disappointed that way. Everything is a beautiful adventure. Everything evolves as it should. And you start to learn the art of surrender. This year taught me to live in that fashion, to not control every minute of my day. Because if you control it, you're squelching any opportunity for magic to happen. It just won't. You can't schedule that in your day. So as we would just let the days unfold, you are presented with these moments of beauty and delight that take your breath away. You know, I mean, think about your life right now. When's the last time something stopped you in your tracks? You know, I hadn't felt that in years, and my soul was so dried up and just, I needed that. Your soul needs that. And that's part of the beauty of adventure and travel. And we began to live in that way. So the travels presented very funny situations. Like she was saying, in Switzerland, we finally got splurged on a hotel with a pool. And we get down there, and there's like all naked people in the pool. And we're like, do we let our beautiful children swim in the naked pool? Or, you know, what is going on? Really going on in this pool? You know, it was things that, you know, we laugh about now, but you never knew what was going to present itself, and you just figured it out as you went.
So do you still approach your days in Arizona like that? Do you decide this weekend we're going to pick up and explore the Superstition Mountains, or do you have that same get up and go and explore feeling that you had when you were in Europe?
You know, I'm more on a spiritual level. You know, because our life, we've got teenagers and, you know, busy lifestyle, and weekends are usually resting and being together. But I can't speak for my husband, but for my own spiritual approach to life is very much so one of surrender and just letting the day take care of itself. I have a couple things that I know I need to get done. And then whatever presents itself, that's what I do. And sometimes the most important part of your day for me is like if I meet someone, like an elderly person at the grocery store who just needed my help, and I don't feel like I have to rush out and go, sorry, you know, do it yourself. You know, I'm like, okay, I have time to take this opportunity to be human and to interact with this person and help them and make their day. And I do that now. And I don't worry if my day doesn't go the way I thought it was going to, or my week, because I know life is unfolding as it should. And even with this book, totally unexpected, I didn't even know I was writing a book. But as doors open, I'm learning now to follow the doors that are opening, not choosing the doors myself. So it's a beautiful, peaceful way to live, and I learned that and learned to trust it on this trip, on that year.
That's lovely. You were religious when you or spiritual when you started mm-hmm. your journey, and I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about how your sense of faith changed.
Well, it changed in the way that I looked at it. Again, you know, we are control oriented as Americans, and so you go into I was raised in a Catholic family and have had a faith filled basis my entire life, and that's an important part of who I am, and raising children that way as well. But it was always on my terms. You know, I'll surrender when I tell you I'm going to surrender, or I'll surrender the way I want to surrender, but I'm still in control. Let's like keep that. You know, I would never have the guts to really put my life in God's hands. I just didn't trust it. And so this trip, it was the first time I did that. I was petrified when I made that decision, because I knew I gave up any sort of normalcy for my future. And I was like, you know what? If God is real this is going to prove it to me. And I kind of need to know at this point in my life. I'm 44. I want to know, what I'm basing my life on. I just was searching on every level. And it turned out to be so beautiful, the way that it all transpired, that it made me more deeply spiritual, I would say, but more trusting in my spirituality is a better way of looking at it.
Someone in the audience wondered why, after having such an amazing experience in Italy, did you come back? And I know you mentioned money is an issue, but I'm wondering if there were any other reasons.
Well, another reason was the schooling for the kids. My daughter was in the IB program. It's called the International Baccalaureate Program, and it's structured differently. And so we knew we had college entrance a year or two ahead of us. And if we were going to stay one more year, we had to stay two more years because of the way the IB is structured. And, our poor kids, and prior to that, we've moved quite a bit as a family. So it's like, how many times can you move your children? What can we put them through? Any other torture? And so we had to decide how much the kids could handle in terms of that. And we knew we could afford one more year. There's no way we could have afforded two. And you have to be responsible at some point with your finances, And so we just came back. We just said, it's not going to work for 3 years. So it was hard to come back. We didn't really want to.
Because do you have any dreams of maybe, when the kids are older, going back there and retiring? Or
we're open. Yeah. And again, I'm not planning it because I'm not sure where our life is going to go. I've learned not to do that. Okay. So as we go along, we'll see what doors open. And if one opens in Italy, I'll be happy with that. and if it doesn't, that's okay too. But we've been back three or four times because we're still in touch with all the people there. And I do want to mention there was a couple there in the book that were important, and it was Giulio and Perangela, and they were an older couple that lived a block down. And they were a big part of our adventure there, and they were like our guardian angels. And my husband met Giulio. Of course, he noticed him and followed him a couple of times. And one day on the boardwalk, just struck up a conversation. They became fast friends. And we struck up this deal where they would come to our house every Tuesday, and they would teach us Italian, and we would teach his wife English because he was fluent. And so I just wanted to make sure before this night was over, just to show again the kindness of strangers is remarkable. And you fear, like, what if I get over there and I can't do this or I can't do that? And you know what, people appear when you need them, these little wonderful friends. And we're still great friends with them today, so I didn't want the night to be over without mentioning their friendship.
Someone asked if your book has been published in Italy.
It has not, believe it or not. And so it has been published in Russia. And Russia, they were on it. Like, it was like wow. Russia and Germany are the two so far that have bought the rights to it. But it's interesting that in Italy they're not crazy about the books, Americans going to Italy books. They're not crazy about that.
So. Italians are a little cynical about that. When I wrote An Italian Affair, same thing, I think that they feel like it's over-romanticizing their culture or something like that. And as fun-loving and all as Italians are, they also really like to sort of complain and not...
That's part of the drama, there's a lot of
but
drama.
But there is sort of a sense that, another American has discovered how good the pizza is,
It's true. That's true.
But I had someone ask if you had any advice for young married college sweethearts.
I do. And I know we have a newlywed in the audience. It's just recently married. I really do. You know what? I think that if you are aware of the role that culture plays in your marriage, it's sort of like a third person coming into your home. And it's important to be hyper aware of that and not let the glamour and beauty of what is available to us all to get in the way of what's important. because family life for us became more goal-oriented than people-oriented. You know, this is what we're going to achieve next and next and next, and you have this illusion of what happiness looks like. Happiness looks like what we see on TV and in the magazines, and all of those are beautiful, and you see it at your neighbor's house, and you see it. So you want all of these things, but what you realize is that's not really what brings you happiness. And happiness is about the interconnectedness of you and your spouse and the people in your family, your spiritual life. Those are the important things that really make you happy. And if you can keep those in the forefront and resist the allure of our materialistic culture, it helps. And I also think that adventure is really important. We are seekers by nature. We need adventure. And you can't just put that into 1 week of your hardworking year. I didn't realize how powerful that was, because when we were over there, there are different types of intimacy. You have spiritual, you have physical intimacy, social intimacy, intellectual intimacy, and physical intimacy. Travel nourishes all of those at once. So you're building all these bridges to each other through travel that happen without effort. And that is powerful and very important in a marriage. And no, I don't remember ever seeing that, reading it. I'm a reader. I don't remember anyone ever telling me that or making me understand that, you know what, spend $2,000 on a trip before you spend $2,000 on a couch. You know, that's what matters in the end, or making all these memories and feeding the intimacy between you and your spouse. How's that, Jenna?
I'm wondering if spending a year in Italy made you a little bit Italian. Like, did you ever get accustomed to, you know, eating the big meal at noon and having a teeny tiny breakfast and having the kids stay up really late and, you know, drinking wine when they're underage? And, you know, did you retain any of those cultural habits?
Well, the wine part. We got really relaxed over there. No, we were still American in our family upbringing. You know, we did relax a little bit, of course, just because we were able to. And I can't say that we became Italian, but it made us much more relaxed as Americans, and to not take everything so seriously, and to enjoy the moment. They're great at enjoying the moment and the people you're with. And that's just the key to life. You know, enjoy where you are. Happiness is being at peace in the moment that you're in, and not to be having your head in 16 different places. And that's the part that I took home and had kept that alive.
So no espressos in the morning with a little brioche, or
just coffee? Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, I do that, but it's not like, you know, I'm religious about it. Yeah.
Increased olive oil consumption.
Yes, increased olive oil. We definitely eat more healthy food and fresh food. You know, you really learn to cook and understand the flavors. And I'm not a chef by any means. Let's not go crazy. But I do understand now, you know, fresh everything that you can. So a little bit, I'd say. It's rubbed off in a good way.
Yeah. Now, someone wanted to ask, how much did your apartment cost to rent?
Sure.
What was the lifestyle? You know, just was it cheaper in Italy? What kinds of things were cheaper?
Well,
what did this whole thing cost you?
I'll be very honest and open with that. Okay, we got there. That apartment, it was very un-Italian. It was the top floor of a 7-story apartment building way up on a hill. It was fantastic. All glass along the front. There were 3 terraces. It was like Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, okay, for that culture. Okay, there were 3 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms. Shocking. That was 2,000 euro a month, is what that cost. So coming from L.A., it was a bargain. you know, for us, because LA is so outrageously expensive. And we just lived in a ranch, like a 2,400 square foot ranch. We weren't in some big mansion. But even so, it was cheaper than our house payment. And so we were able to afford that. You know, if it was some cramped, tiny apartment, clearly that was part of the deal. So if the thing wasn't outrageous, we weren't going to do it. And then all of a sudden, it was beautiful, really pretty.
And so why did you choose Liguria? I mean, you said you sort of just got on the train, but is that really how you were in Firenze and you just were like, where's the next train going? Or did you have some sense that you wanted to, you'd heard about the Cinque Terre, maybe we'll go to Liguria, and, you know, why
well,
not?
Well, it was a work trip. Mm-hmm. They had two stops. You're going to go to Florence, you're going to entertain 3 days there or 4 days there and 2 days in Liguria, and then you're flying home. We had nothing to do with it, and we didn't research it. We did not think it through. We were literally standing, and we said, let's move right here, not knowing anything other than the fact that where we were standing was so beautiful that it just spoke to our soul, and we're just like, we're moving here. And now, knowing Italy as well as I do, I would still choose the same region. It's very Italian, so you cannot... Like in Florence, there's so many Americans that it's easy to just hang with the Americans, you know. So it forced us to push our limits in scary ways. I never thought I could do what I did, you know. To really push yourself over every self-imposed limit you've ever envisioned is exhilarating and frightening at the same time. It's just fantastic.
What were some of the other regions in Italy you visited?
Well, you know, we went to Tuscany, of course, mm-hmm. and then we went north. There's a Piemonte is the region north.
I just came back from Piemonte.
They have great red wines. And, you know, we went down as far as Rome and didn't make it too much further than that. And it's funny, though, because north and south is kind of like northern and southern California, how they, you know, you have your ideas of each other. And so, like, Giglio, for example, has lived there his entire life. He's never set foot south of Rome.
Wow.
He won't, he says.
It's like us. We won't go south of San Luis Obispo.
He says, barbarians. So it's very funny, you know, and... So we went south as far as Rome, and then most of all the northern regions.
Someone asked whether Francis May's Under the Tuscan Sun influenced your writing or your story.
No, you know, I didn't even read the book. And when we made the decision, I received two copies as a gift, and I didn't want to read her story because I wanted to just have an experience. And I didn't read it until about halfway through our stay there. And I even wrote about that in our book. It made me a little bitter because here she is building this beautiful villa and, you know, and we're like schlepping up these steps and no car. You know, it was kind of funny. But it didn't influence us at all. And, you know, more power to her for what she has built. That's a beautiful thing. But our experience was completely different.
So we've reached the point where we just have time for one last quick question. And tell us a little bit about your journey to publishing the book. You hadn't written books before.
I've never written a book before. I did not know I was writing a book. Now, I was studying screenwriting because if you live in L.A., you have to write a screenplay. It's kind of an unwritten rule. But I was fascinated by it. We had been there. I'm from the East Coast originally. So when we moved out and you're surrounded by all of these creative people, it is inspiring. And I was studying screenwriting for a while. I'd written quite a few screenplays. Could not sell them because it's very hard to break into. And so when we got to Italy, I was done with all that. I'm like, you know what? That's just not working for me and I'm not good enough. But I had a girlfriend who challenged me, and she said, I think you're making a big mistake. You should not do this. And a couple of other friends who were sitting with us said, will you write to us and really tell us what it's like? Like, don't lie. And I said, yeah, I can do that. So I as we would go through our days, if a moment hit me deeply, either a sad moment or a funny moment or something that hit a chord, I sat and wrote it as a scene because I knew how to write a scene. And I started sending them off to friends. And it started to garner a following. And at one point, probably in November, we were there and started in July, a friend from Washington, D.C., who's a journalist, wrote to me and he said, I think you should stop sending these out. I think you have a book here. And I had never even considered it until that moment. And so I thought, well, I'll give it a try. So as the year went on, I just continued to write those scenes, and I compiled them. And when we got back, I just went about it the old-fashioned way. I looked for an agent and then, you know, had to rewrite it 7,500 times. And then found a publisher. And it's just one of those books that it's a story that found its way because people are finding hope in the story, and it's something good right now as we all struggle with the economy and our marriages, and it's powerful. So I'm very proud of it, and I'm happy to share it for that reason. We've had an amazing response, beautiful letters, heartfelt letters from people from really all over the world have written, and make me thankful that we had the guts to share such a deeply personal story because it's helping others.
It's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Our thanks to Susan Pullman, author of Halfway to Each Other, How a Year in Italy Brought Our Family Home. We also want to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Laura Fraser, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.